Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we're listening to a compelling account of life on death row and the lies that sent Nathan Fields there for almost 20 years. Americans are talking about the death penalty these days. Arkansas pledged to put 8 death row prisoners to death in 11 days in an effort to use up one of the drugs used in lethal injection before it expired at the end of last month. Court orders eventually blocked half of the scheduled executions, but 4 men, the last one late last Thursday night, were put to death. Nathan Fields knows more about their experiences on death row than he'd like. In 1985, he was arrested and wrongly convicted of a double murder in Chicago. Last month, UMD's Criminology Club invited Fields to UMD to talk about his experiences.
My name is Nathan Fields. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. And this is my story of how I wound up on death row for something I didn't do. In 1984, 2 black males were shot and killed in Chicago, Illinois, in front of a housing project. The assailants was allegedly to be 2 African-American males between the age of 17 and 19. In 1985, I was arrested for this crime 13 months after it occurred. I was not light-skinned. I was the same complexion I am now, which is dark-skinned. I was 30 years old. I wasn't 17 or 19. Also at this time, I was a building manager of a building, a 3-flat building in Chicago. I also was a part of an organization, an Afrocentric organization called El Rukins. But the police, they looked at it as a gang, and they was cracking down on it. So one morning, on June 13th of 1985, I got in my car, and I did what I always do. I went around the block, and I was on my way to the coffee shop to get a cup of coffee. I was about maybe a half a block from my house when a blue and white patrol car came behind me and turned the lights on and pulled me over. I knew I wasn't speeding, so I just figured maybe he just wanted to see if I had a license. So when he pulled me over, he told me to step out the car, which I did. He told me give him my driver's license, which I did. He said, just stand right there. I want to, you know, going back to the car. And as I stood there, 2 black unmarked police cars pulled up on me, right up on me like this from both sides, and stopped. And the policemen got out with their guns out on me. So I told them, I'm not gonna move. And I just put my hands on my car. I said, I'm not gonna move. I didn't know what was going on. They handcuffed me. They put me in the squad car. And they got in my car, and we all went to the police station. When I got to the police station, I heard one of the cops who had arrested me say, see you in 40 years, Nate. And I didn't understand what he meant by that. I went in the police station. The police didn't say much or nothing to me. They fingerprinted me and some other things and put me in a cell. So I stayed there all night like that. They hadn't told me what I was there for. So the next day came, and the officers came to my cell and took me out the cell, and he took me in another room. And this room, it didn't have much in it, but it had about 3 or 4 rings sticking out the wall. I didn't know what it was for until I walked in when the cop pulled his cuffs out and cuffed my wrist, my right wrist, to one of those hoops and told me to sit down. And so he walked out. And suddenly this sergeant comes in, and he just comes right up to me and said, you're going to jail. It's all over for you. You are going to jail. You're not getting out. You're this, you're that. And I'm like, nobody even told me what I'm here for. And so I was sitting in the chair, and so he walked up to me where it was like his crouch was in my face. And I couldn't, you know, I'm sitting down, so he was just screaming and shouting at me, looking down. And I just stood up out of instinct. His crouch was in my face. I just stood up like, man. And so he jumped back and said, oh, you trying to get fresh. He went out the room. He came back in. And he had another officer with him. He was behind this other officer when he came in. The other officer had a baton about this long. And he had it in his hand like this, walking towards me with the sergeant behind him. So I was standing up now with my handcuff. So he walked over to me. He racked me across my solar plex, and I fell to the floor. And they left out. So later on, they came and got me for a lineup. So as I was in the lineup, they was telling all of us, turn to the right, to the front, you know, to the left. And I was doing all of that. But what I noticed, every time I turned a certain way to the right, I had a tattoo on my arm that identified me as a member of El Rucan. And every time I turned to the right, this policeman who was in the lineup, he would raise my sleeve up. And I didn't understand why he kept raising my sleeve when I turned to. So when I turned the other way, I would roll it back down. So I turned back around, he rolled it back up. And he told me to turn right, turn left, and I rolled it down again. When I turned around, he said, you do that again, I'm going to run your head through that wall. He said, now look at that dot. And I just asked him, why you just keep raising my sleeve? He said, you just look at that dot and keep quiet. So the next day, they took me for arraignment. Didn't even tell me I was going for arraignment. I didn't even know what I was there for. I went for the arraignment, and I heard the judge say, you was being charged with 2 counts of double murder. I almost fainted. They gave me a co-defendant, and they gave me a judge. The case was so weak, just on its face, the fact that I was arrested 13 months later, the fact that I didn't fit the description to begin with, the attorney I had was sure that we would get a not guilty verdict. So we went with a bench trial. We wanted to keep it simple. The state put the evidence on, and we tried to weaken their case and show the holes in it, which we did. We clearly showed. But the judge found me guilty. And I was really shocked and disheartened. After that, jury was impaneled. And this was for the case was death qualified because it was 2 people murdered. And so a jury was instituted, and they was going to determine my fate, whether or not I got life in prison or the death penalty. After 2 days of deliberations, the jury came in and said, we can't reach a verdict. And the judge said, well, we're going to let y'all stay at the hotel for the weekend. It was a Friday night. He said, y'all going to stay at the hotel for the weekend. He said, I'm going to give you another hour to go back and see if y'all can get a verdict. They went in the back and came out in 30 minutes, and they gave me the death penalty. I watched my family run out the courtroom. I had a girlfriend then. My girlfriend was pregnant with my daughter. Ran out the courtroom. Didn't hit me until I got to the bullpen that I had the death penalty. That to the side, the reality did hit me when they marched me inside a Pontiac death row. I was chained, shackled. They had a dog chain between my legs. So they brought me on the flag of death row, and they moved me up against the wall and just stopped. But when I looked around, I saw 2 levels of cells, 60 cells on each level, and I could see all the guys standing at the bars looking at me. I saw 20-year-olds, 30, 40, 50-year-old men. And I just couldn't believe all these people was on death row. They looked just like each one of you. Late at night, that very first day, when the lights went off and it was was dark. I just started hearing things. I started hearing guys yelling on the gallery that I didn't hear earlier. They was calling out imaginary names. Some was screaming out their wives and mother's name, their girlfriends, their kids. Some guy was just crying. I asked the guy next to me, "What's all that I'm hearing?" He said, "Get used to it." He said, "Because it goes on every night."
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. UMD's Criminology Club invited Nathan Fields to UMD to talk about his experiences. Fields spent almost 20 years in prison and on death row after being wrongly convicted of a double murder he didn't commit. Fields is now the board chair for Witness to Innocence.
I want to tell you now a little bit about life on death row. You're locked up 23 hours a day. You're allowed out 1 hour per day. Everywhere you go for, you come out the cell, you're already handcuffed. When you come out, you shackled. You got a chain on you. I felt like a dog. I was there for 11 executions, and during that time, approximately about another 12 died from lack of medical care. But their mentality on death row was, we're not here to literally take care of you. We are here to execute you. So medication and sugar diabetes and high blood pressure medication was very low on the list with the prison administration. John Posh, he was charged with the murder of a Chicago policeman. He was a very unique prisoner. He was an elderly white man. He was two cells from me. He never went to the yard. He never went to the rec. He never went to religious service. He never went to a visit to see his own family members. He wouldn't even accept the mail from anyone, lawyers, family, no one. He just stayed in the cell, smoked cigarettes. So one day, he came out of the cell. He said, "Nate," and I turned around, I'm like, I was shocked because he never comes out. He said, "Nate, last night, I had a pain in my chest. It felt like somebody had their foot on my heart." And I immediately told the guy, "Oh, man. Got to get him a sick call. That might be a heart attack." He didn't pay no mind to me. And we were so mindful of what had happened to so many other guys. We had already said, we got to do something, man. We ain't got to sit here and let's do something. Let's try to make them do their job, man. Can we get some medication? And so this was it. We started it. We started beating the bars with our cups, our shoes, anything we can get our hands on, books, making all the noise we could. And we was telling them, get some brass back here. And eventually they did. They brought some brass back. And he came back to my cell. "What's going on?" And I said, "Well, this man just said that he had a pain in his chest last night. It felt like somebody had a foot on his heart. And we feel he's about to have a heart attack. Y'all need to look at him, check him out or something, because this man had no reason to come out the cell. He never comes out. So he ain't asking for no favors." And then this brass told me, I think he was a lieutenant, he was mad just coming back there. He said, "You need to mind your own business." He said, "Why are you concerned about other people? You need to be concerned about yourself." And I told him, "I'm concerned about other people because if I get like that man right there, I want somebody to help me." He said, "You need to mind your own business." Just walked away from me. So we saw it ain't no help coming. So we all tried to play doctor. Somebody said, "I got a 7-Up. Maybe you need to burp. Pass it down." So we passed it down the gallery. We gave it to John. He drunk the 7-Up. "I think I'm feeling a little better." And so another guy said, "I got a Sprite. Send it down." Passed it down, gave it to him. John said, "I'm feeling even better now." So we really was thinking, okay, this ain't a bad one. Okay, all right. One guy said he was going to stay up the night to try to keep an eye on them if they hear anything or him coughing or anything. The next morning came, and the guards, they came around, did their little count, head check, and they got to John's cell, and they turned around and started running back up front. John was dead. He died of a heart attack. The sad thing about John is, after he died, the United States Supreme Court reversed his case. But that's just dealing with the medical care. Now I want to move you to executions. I was there for 11, and I knew all the guys. But I'll tell you about one who was one of my friends. I had two really good friends. This was one. His name was Ray Stewart. His execution date had come. And he was guilty. He told me, I did it. He had the murder of a convenience store clerk, 17 years old. He said, but I don't want to die for it. I told him, well, got to pray on it. Let's pray on it. So we was going out to the yard this day before his execution, and the guards was coming around telling everybody that it's going to be a furious rainstorm, and it's going to be thundering lightning. If you guys go out there, you're going to be out there. So you better think about it. We thought they was trying to discourage us from going to the yard, like they always do. We got on the yard, and we did what we always do. We started playing basketball. And only this day, Ray was making all the baskets. He was running around shooting like Michael Jordan. So suddenly, during the game, he just stopped. Ray stopped and said, wait a minute, wait a minute. And he looked at me and he said, I know what y'all doing. He looked at me. Y'all know what's going to happen tomorrow. You're letting me make all the buckets. And we like, man, we just want you to have a good time, man. He said, no, play me the way you've been playing me. We like, okay. So he go up for a basket. We'll tackle him like we playing football. So the yard, it was okay. It was okay. But then the rain did come, and it was furious. It wasn't no lightning or thunder, but it was furious. And we saw the guards looking out the window like, yeah, we told y'all. They looking at the window, they're smiling, yeah. And we like, oh, man, rain tearing us up. But we brought some garbage bags out. We smuggled some garbage bags out. The guards were looking out the window like almost cheering that we was getting flooded out on the rain. And so we reached down and pulled these little garbage bags out, made a Mr. Potato Man. And then we kept walking with Ray, and the guards was like, oh, dog. Oh. In the rain, we still walk with him. All good. The execution day starts off with one of the loudest sounds I had ever heard at that time. I had never been around a helicopter. The helicopter came in and landed in the yard of the prison that was going to take him to the execution chamber. When they brought him out, all of us were standing at our bars just to get a look at him. I couldn't say anything. I couldn't find a word. And so he just nodded at me. So later that night, it came over the news. Ray Stewart was put to death by lethal injection. So when we heard that, you know, we turned our radios down, things like that. Everybody got quiet. And one guy says the Lord's Prayer. Another one says the Muslim prayer. The Muslims say the Muslim prayer. And we had one prisoner, I don't know to this day, none of us know how he done it. The guards would always bum rush his cell afterwards to try to find what was he using. But he erects a banjo, and he would play the most beautiful song that, for the moment, it was the most beautiful song. I thought things couldn't get worse, and then they started executing us two at a time. And so now, they was coming by the cell with two guys instead of one. And that's when it seemed like half a death row just started just losing it. Guys who helped me with coffee, guys who helped me with write-outs and told me how things go, they were losing their mind. They didn't even recognize me. It was just awful. They wouldn't even speak to me no more. They didn't recognize me almost. And it like started happening overnight. They started talking to themselves and just all sorts of things. Another guy never took a shower. All he do is just scream at night, just scream, scream, scream. And we can never stop him from screaming. And he just screams. He don't take showers. He looked like a caveman. Guards know he lost his mind, but they didn't even care. I thought it couldn't get no worse. But then one day I woke up and the chaplain was at my door, or at my cell door. And he said, "Nate, your mother died." It's like it didn't even hit me. I said, "Well, what did she die from?" "She had a heart attack." I asked him, "Will I be able to go to the funeral?" He said, "No." He said, "They say you're a security risk. Nobody on death row will go to funerals." So he left my cell, and then it hit me. And I didn't come out of my cell for another 90 days.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. UMD's Criminology Club invited Nathan Fields to UMD to talk about his experiences. Fields spent almost 20 years in prison and on death row after being wrongly convicted of a double murder he didn't commit. Fields is now the board chair for Witness to Innocence.
And suddenly a miracle happened. A guy in the cell next door to me, he said, "Nate, you in the newspaper?" I said, "Oh, ain't nobody talking about me no more." In the article, it said that the judge who had found me guilty had just been indicted by the government for taking bribes in murder cases, including my own. They gave me a co-defendant on the case. His lawyer was a crook. He had bribed the judge on other occasions. And so the feds been on the phone watching, trying to catch them. The feds came into my courtroom during my trial. They sat on the front row. I didn't know none of this. They was trying to look to see the lawyer pass the money to the judge. I didn't even know. They indicted him, and he was found guilty. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison. What the feds found out was that he took a bribe from my co-defendant's attorney to throw the case. They had dealt like this before. I knew nothing about the bribe. He gave it back when the FBI came into the room because he thought they was up on the bribe. He gave the money back to the attorney, and he found me guilty and my co-defendant in a desperate attempt to cover it up. This judge now is considered the most corrupt judge in American history. We filed for a new trial, and the state's attorney said they still could execute me despite the judge being corrupt. And this argument went on before the Illinois Supreme Court. And my attorneys were like, "There's no way that can be true. This man was a crook. He took a bribe. He was not fair." And the Supreme Court sided with me. The state's attorney had said on my appeal that they said that they wasn't going to retry me when I came back because it ain't no case. They never had a case. But when I came back for the new trial, the state's attorney back at the courthouse said they don't have to honor what the state's attorney on appeal said to the Illinois Supreme Court. I stayed at the county jail 5 years fighting the case, waiting to be retried. Governor Ryan emptied out death row in Illinois and ended the death penalty. And he freed four guys, and one was my other best friend, Aaron Patterson, who always told me he was innocent. When the governor pardoned him, he was awarded over $199,000. He took $100,000 and came bond me out. That's how I got out. After I got out, I was happy, but I still had the case pending on my head. But it was other difficulties I was running into every day that I did not calculate. Pumping gas, that was left to attendants when I left the street. It was someone that would pump your gas for you. Now you got to do your own. I had never done that. One of my main difficulties was crossing the street. I still had some health when I came home. And it was just like the cars were just moving so fast. I just couldn't remember the cars moving that fast. And my timing was off. And I walk out into the street thinking, okay, the cars, I got this, no problem. And the cars right there stopping. And I'm like, oh, man. So I was staying with my sister when I came home. And two of my nephews were there. One was 7, one was 8. And everywhere I went, I took them with me. When I got to the stoplight, I would stand there, and I would wait until my nephews moved. I was in a grocery store one time buying some items, And the lady behind the counter, she rung up everything. And so I was standing there, and she was standing there, and she looked at me. And then she said, "You don't see that?" I'm like, "What? The price." Oh, I said, "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." And somebody in the line said, "Idiot." And I turned around, and I said, I looked at the person. I said, "If only you knew. If only you knew." So my trial eventually started. It lasted a couple of months, and I was found not guilty by the fair judge. After that, they have what's called a certificate of innocence, a document that declares that legally you're innocent. And I represented myself against the two prosecutors who was trying to send me back to death row, and I won. And I was compensated over $199,000. With that, I filed the largest lawsuit in Illinois' history. So the first civil trial started, I think it was in 2015, March. The city felt they was going to lose the case. And one of the defendants that I was suing, one of the cops, he blurted out something that he wasn't supposed to blurt out, that the judge had told him not to do, to sabotage the case. And it did. It caused a mistrial of a case. At that point, I surely was going to win. So we started the second trial after that. This trial, I had 11 white males and one woman. They had a hard time even looking at me. And so I felt like, oh man, they're not gonna give me a fair shake. But I kept my hopes up. But when they came back, they found the cops liable, but they just gave me $80,000. And I told the press afterwards, this is a travesty of justice. It's a travesty of justice. And so I appealed that. And before it really got on a serious appeal, the trial judge, he reversed the whole verdict. And they found out that the city had withheld some deals that they had gave to some witnesses they had brought in. And so now my third civil trial began. And this was just this past November. The one witness who had identified me out the lineup, when he got on the stand, the city attorney walked behind me and said, "And you identified, this is the man that killed those two people in front of the project. He's one of the men that did it, correct?" And the witness said, "I can't say that no more." The whole courtroom went silent. So they would not ask him anything to go deep into it, but when my lawyers crossed him, he brought it all out. He said, "I've been lying ever since they told me to say he was the man. I don't even know that man." You know, the verdict came in. We all went in the courtroom, and they found both of the cops who I was suing liable. They found the city of Chicago liable, and I won. They gave me over $20 million. I only was asking for $20. They gave me $22. I told them, my life moves forward now. I feel that the money can only do so much for me because it can't bring back those years. And that's the one thing that troubles me. I don't know what it feels like to, you know, I was 30 years old. So I don't know what it feels like to be 40. I don't know what I would have been doing. So in essence, I'll give all the money back. Give me my time on this earth. I thank you for having me.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Thanks to UMD's Criminology Club, Scott Bollum, and Nathan Fields. We've set up a link to Witness to Innocence on our webpage, and you can find it at KUMD.org. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.